This is a fun Sunday that you showed up because of this preaching series that we're in. Some of you are already looking at this text that I'm about to preach on, and you're like, yeah, James is laughing. What did I just get myself into? 45 verses in Daniel chapter 11. I want to tell you, I see a clock in front of me. I know it's there. I also want you to know that this is one of the texts that they warn you about in seminary when you're learning to preach. It's famously complex, and I came across one scholar earlier this week who said this is the kind of passage that's very good for Bible study or for a Sunday school class, but certainly nobody could preach on it. It's like super encouraging. So I'm asking for your prayers as we do this. Over the past week, I want you to know that the more I've studied this chapter, the more I see its relevance for you and for me. These are important matters that God is leading his people into, and it's worth our whole attention. Let me set the stage a little bit for you. The last three chapters of Daniel are one vision. He brought him into looking at this one last vision to close the book. And in last week in chapter 10, what we saw is that God is fighting for us in the spiritual world, that there is a conflict that rages in the heavens. And he is very much fighting for us. And somehow, we don't know all the details of this, but somehow they reflect or interact with the conflicts we see all around us every day in the world. And as we lean into chapter 11, what we're looking at this morning is a perspective of many future conflicts that are in front of the people of God, several centuries worth that we're going to look at. And then in chapter 12, what we'll see is a perspective of future victory. Chapter 11, but for today, we're talking about this perspective of future conflict that God gives in this vision that God gives to Daniel. And this is a place, what I'm about to give you, if you have a pen handy, you might want this time. Verses 1 through 19 are about 370 years worth of conflict that will surround God's people and will interact with them some. And then in verses 20 through 35, you're going to see a very particular conflict, about four or five years worth of conflict that's going to have a very real bearing on the life of God's people. Conflict is going to come right to their front doorstep. And then starting in verse 36 through 45, you're looking at a perspective of a future conflict to come, one very far off in the future. Just the way those break down. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm going to read sections from each of those sections and then begin to talk it through. But let me put this thought into your mind before I begin reading. God does not give this vision to God's people to overwhelm them with despair. He does not give this to them so that they would be afraid of the future. But in fact, one of the things I want you to hear this morning is that God gives Daniel 11 to Daniel and his people as an encouragement to them. Let's look. I'm going to read verses 1 through 6, and then I'll jump forward and read verses 29 through 35. And then I'll jump forward again and read verses 40 through 45. Okay? 1 through 6, 29 through 35, 40 through 45. Hear the word of the Lord. And as for me, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. And then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these. And then the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger than he, and shall rule, and his authority shall be a great authority. And after some years, they shall make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north, to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and his arm shall not endure, but she shall be given up, and her attendants, he who fathered her, and he who supported her in those times. And it's story after story after that of conflict like this that goes on for centuries to come. And we'll move forward to verse 29 through 35. At the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south, but it shall not be this time as it was before, for ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw, and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the Holy Covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. And forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering. And then shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant. But the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. And the wise among the people shall make many understand. Though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. And when they stumble, they shall receive a little help. And many shall join themselves to them with flattery. And some of the wise shall stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end. For it still awaits the appointed time. And then verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, but the king of the north shall rush upon him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and with many ships, and he shall come into countries and shall overflow and pass through. He shall come into the glorious land, and tens of thousands shall fall, but these shall be delivered out of his hand, Edom and Moab and the main part of the Ammonites. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall become ruler of the treasures of gold and of silver and all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans and the Cushites shall follow in his train. But news from the east and the north shall alarm him, and he shall go out with great fury to destroy and devote many to destruction. And he shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountain, and yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Lord, I ask for help, not just for me, but for all of these friends. These things are too big for us. We know that Daniel was overwhelmed when he received this vision, and we might be too. And so I pray that would you greet our uncertainty with a real certainty about who you are? Would you dwell generously amongst your people? And would you help me to serve you faithfully, to serve these friends faithfully? And I ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. So long before Abraham Lincoln was president, he was a young lawyer who was riding the judicial circuit in Illinois. That's probably not news to many of you. But at that time, Illinois was still very much frontier country. And so what that meant was that he was traveling a lot from town to town on horseback, with a crew of other lawyers and judges who were all on this circuit going from town to town to attend the cases that waited for them there. And he talked a lot about all that these journeys meant to him, about how these friendships that he had developed along the way. They would travel together on horseback. They would spend the night in, you know, random inns along the way. They would stay up late. The legend of Abraham Lincoln's storytelling really first came out around this time. Apparently he was a great storyteller. But one night, instead of listening to stories, they were all worried about what was going to happen the next day because it had just been raining for days in that area. It was just terrible downpour. The roads were a mess. The rivers had become very dangerous to cross, and they knew that the very next day they had to cross this river called the Fox River. And the Fox River was dangerous to cross when the weather was good, when the river level was normal, but they were all worried about what it was going to be when they finally got to the Fox River the next day, how they were going to handle that. And this is the part of the story that I loved. They decided that they would consult the pastor who apparently was on the journey with them. It was the Methodist presiding elder of the circuit was his title. What a great title. They called him Father B. And they knew that Father B had traveled this country a lot, and they came to him and they said, "What do you know about this Fox River?" And sensing their anxiety about the next day, he says, "Oh yes, I know all about the Fox River. I know every detail of it. I've crossed it when the weather was good. I've crossed it when the weather was bad. And I have a singular rule when it comes to the Fox River. I never cross it until I reach it." Now that sounds like wisdom. That sounds like the kind of wisdom Abraham Lincoln told that story over and over and over again to a nation that was increasingly worried about what was to come. "I never cross it until I reach it." That sounds like good wisdom. That also sounds like common wisdom. Mark Twain once said, "I've had a lot of worries in my life, most of which never happened." To the Christian, that doesn't just sound like common wisdom. That sounds like wisdom that's born of faith. It sounds like spiritual wisdom. Jesus said, "Don't worry about what's to come tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself." He was saying, your Father loves you very, very, very much, and he knows what you need. And if that's true, if all of that's true, then I think it begs a question about this chapter, Daniel chapter 11. If the God who doesn't want us to worry about the future, don't be afraid, if that's true, then why is he filling Israel's mind and your mind and my mind with a vision of all of these conflicts that are to come? Why is he doing that? Well, I want to give you three reasons. When you look at verses 1 through 19, I want you to see that God is teaching them and us something very important about the nature of conflict. And then when you look at verses 20 through 35, I want you to see that God is preparing the Israelites for a conflict that is to come. And then finally, when you look at verses 36 through 45, what I want you to see is that God is assuring them and assuring you and me of a time when there will be no more conflict ever again. He's teaching us, he's preparing us, and he's assuring us. First, let's talk about him teaching us. I mentioned this earlier, but I want you to see that the camera is wide here. Between verses 1 through 19, this is 370 years of history, about 8 generations worth of history is collapsed into these 19 verses. It begins with when the Persians overthrew the Babylonians. You see that reference, and then you also see Alexander the Great show up very early on in verses 3 and 4. You see a prophecy about Alexander the Great. We've mentioned all this before in previous visions, but you see Alexander the Great's great kingdom get divided up to 4 of his generals, you see, but not to his posterity. That phrase there, I think it's in verse 4. That's simply a reference to how Alexander the Great's kingdom didn't go to his sons, but it was broken up amongst 4 of his generals. And these 4 kingdoms, at this point, starting in verse 5, the history or the vision really narrows in on 2 of the 4 of these kingdoms, okay? And I'm going to do my best with hand motions to draw a little map for you or gesture to maps, okay? You'll see reference to the King of the North and the King of the South. These titles are repeated over and over and over again, okay? The King of the South is a reference to the Ptolemy. The Ptolemy dynasty that is one of those kingdoms that broke out of Alexander the Great's kingdom. When you think of the Ptolemies, think of Egypt, Alexandria, think that way. So south and west of Israel. And then the King of the North, this is a reference to the Northern dynasty, which were the Seleucids. The Seleucids, think Iran, Iraq, Turkey, Syria, think this way. So you got, actually, you're looking at me, so this way, right? And what do you see? You got conflict that's raging all around them, and Israel's right between the two of them, okay? And so what I want you to see is that Daniel, when he receives this vision about a king of the north in constant conflict with a king of the south, and you see all this, and as you read through, you see intrigue, you see human selfishness that knows no limits, you see deception, you see death, you see kings getting strong, all of this is happening all around Israel. And so what is he seeing? He is seeing a world that is characterized by uncertainty. Geopolitical uncertainty in close proximity to Israel's land. Remember, this is right after their exile. As they return home, this is what you have to look forward to, is just characterized by uncertainty. And I would just propose that you're familiar with the uncertainty that this kind of turmoil creates. I hesitate to say this. I'm really not trying to brag, okay? This is not a brag. I read the news. I read the news almost every day, and I read it from three different sources, and part of that's because I just want to be reading what you read. And one of the things I did this past week is just looking at all the different phrases that I read that communicate uncertainty in some way. And it's like every article, every paragraph, almost every sentence, certainly every bullet point that I would read would just contain a phrase that would communicate to us just how much uncertainty there is in the world. And it didn't matter what they were talking about. Phrases like we live in a tenuous and fragile moment. I mean, I just saw phrases like this everywhere. What was the other one? The future remains an open question. I mean, all of that was laid out for us, is communicated constantly, and it didn't matter what they were talking about. They could be talking about the state of the environment. They could be talking about the future of the markets. They could be talking about peace or a particular peace deal, or the strength of a particular peace deal. They could have been talking about the state of relationships. More is being written on this, more now than I've seen in a long while. More is being written on the state of relationships, the state of families, the state of loneliness amongst people. It didn't matter. All of these credentialed, intelligent, capable journalists can write very, very well about the state of all of these things. They can write very, very well about what they see. They can write very, very well about how all these things are affecting each other. But what none of them can do is talk about where these things are going. It seems like uncertainty is like the common byline or byword of our day. And one of the things I want you to see is that that's not new. There's nothing new about that. And I would want you to recognize the way all of this uncertainty affects us, and it does. We're kidding ourselves if the uncertainty of the world doesn't have an effect on us. It affects the hope we have for our children. It does affect us financially, it does. It affects the state of our relationships. It can make us more self-protective. It can make us less of a risk taker, less willing to lean into the world the way that God would want us to. Listen, it can overwhelm us with despair about the future. It can do all of those things. And one of the things I want you to see is that in these passages, despair is not what God is aiming at. And there are two points that I want to make about why God is curbing us against despair in these passages. The first is just how specific all these stories are. I mean, it is why. Remember, this prophecy was given in 539 BC. And what we see here are incredibly detailed and specific prophecies about what is to come 50, 100, 200, up to 370 years after this prophecy was delivered. Like God is communicating, I know all of the details of it. One scholar said this. She said, all a reader needs is a history book of the period to fill in the names and places conveyed. I want to just give you an example. I read to you verse 6, okay? Look back at verse 6. And when you do, remember that this prophecy was given in 539 BC, and just about everybody, whether they believe that this is divine prophecy or not, locates this story in 250 BC, okay? This is what it says. After some years, they shall make an alliance, thinking about the king of the north, the king of the south, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north. So there's a daughter involved, right? To make an agreement. So there's a peace treaty that's being done. But she shall not retain the strength of her arm. What does that mean? And he and his arm shall not endure, but she shall be given up, and her attendant, and he who fathered her. So her dad is somehow involved in all of this. And he who supported her in those times. This all came true right down to the letter. Just like the scholar said, all you got to do is fill in the places and the names. Here's what happened. So you got the king of the south is around 250 BC. So we're talking about Ptolemy II at this point is trying to make a peace treaty with the king of the north. This would be Antiochus II by giving his daughter, her name is Berenice, to him in marriage. But in order for Antiochus to receive Berenice, well, he first has to divorce his present wife. Her name is Laodice. Laodice wasn't having any of that. And so what she did was she poisoned everybody. I'm not kidding. This all happened. She poisoned Antiochus. She poisoned Berenice. You see a bunch of other people died. And then to top it all off, Berenice's father also happened to die that year. All of it came true. Down to the very last detail. And so why is this important for the Israelites to know? Why is it important for you and I to know? That God is communicating, I am aware. I know you can know that I know. I know their suffering, and listen, I know your suffering. I know it all down to the very last detail. And not only do I know, but I am working. Where do we see God working in these passages? And I wish there were a better way to say this, but, well, I'm sure there is, but and if you think of it, you can. But the key to seeing God at work is in the word but in this passage, B-U-T, B-U-T, but. 14 times the word but is in this passage, and every time it shows that God's hand is at work, curbing the path of history. You see this in verse 11. The king of the south is on the move, but he shall not prevail. Verse 17, but it shall not stand or be to his advantage. Verse 17, or verse 18, but a commander shall put an end to his indolence. Verse 19, but he shall stumble and fall. Verse 20, but within a few days he shall be broken. It just goes on like this over and over and over again. There's this pattern that you see that God is seeing kings rise. God is seeing kings fall. Eventually, their power can be broken. Between verses 4 and 29, there are 14 of these. All of them show that God is curbing history away from the ongoing prosperity of the arrogant ruler, away from the strength that seems to overwhelm. He's teaching us something important about the nature of conflict in the world. And we need to know these things. One person put it this way. I love the way he put it. He said, the Israelites are learning that these powerful figures, we got a few powerful figures that consume our heart's attention right now, don't we? These powerful figures rise up and God brings them down. And what they will find out is that people who are down are the ones that he brings up. And the Israelites are going to need to know that. You and I are going to need to know that. Especially as we go into this next section, starting in verse 20. God is preparing the people for a very specific encounter with one of these kingdoms. The camera is zooming in at this verse. This is going to span about 4 or 5 years of conflict, from 168 to 164 BC, where a man described as a contemptible person in verse 20, 21 shows up. Who is this contemptible person? Well, everyone agrees that the person that's being described in this passage is a man named Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus IV, is arriving in that passage. We've referenced him in several sermons already. We've detailed a lot of the atrocities of his rule. Why did he come there? Well, he came because he was embarrassed. I want you to see this. This is in verse 21. He was the king of the Seleucid dynasty. And starting in verse 29, he went to make war in Egypt, as so many of these Seleucid kings had done. They went to Egypt to attack the Ptolemy dynasty. There's a conflict that, you know, this is like the Hatfields and the McCoys, except it's just, you know, on and on and on and on. We don't know why they rivaled so much, but they just did. And he does what every other Seleucid king had done before him, and he, in his ambition, went to go attack Egypt. But a new figure, a powerful figure, arrives on the world stage, starting in verse 30. Is it verse 30? It is. It's verse 30. You see, it mentioned the ships of Kittim. Well, that's Rome. Rome has arrived. The ships of Kittim are Roman ships. Rome, by this point, had become very interested in the stability of the area. And they just can't have these Seleucid kings coming down with their armies and attacking these Ptolemies on the Mediterranean coast. We just can't have that anymore. And so as the story goes, Antiochus Epiphanes arrives with all of his people, his troops behind them. They arrive in Alexandria, and who meets them is not the king of the Ptolemies, but a Roman general himself. This is a high noon showdown. Everybody is watching. And this Roman general comes up to Antiochus Epiphanes, a proud man. His last name means he gave himself the nickname Epiphanes, which I have a lot of things to say about anybody who would give themselves a nickname. But this nickname in particular means God manifest. You see how he's elevating himself? You can see his arrogance in all of this. And this Roman general comes out to meet him as he approaches Alexandria. And he says, you will get the heck out of Egypt or we will kill you. We will kill you all. And Antiochus Epiphanes says, he hesitated. And so this general drew a circle in the sand around him. And he says, you will make up your mind right now what you will do before you step out of this circle. Everybody was watching. He was humiliated. And so what did he do next? Verse 30. It says he turns back enraged and takes action against the people of the Holy Covenant. These are the Israelites themselves. And so what I want you to see, I want you to see two things in this passage. One is a leader using his position to resolve his sense of shame or embarrassment or to prove his strength is capable of immense destruction. I just want you to see that, to know that. And this guy was destructive. I don't want to detail all that he did. Some of those are mentioned there, but just to say that over the course of 5 years, 80,000 men, women, and children in Israel died under his rule. Clearly, God is giving these people a vision to prepare them for what's to come. Here's the other reason. Israel did not provoke him. Israel weren't the cause of his shame or embarrassment. This is persecution. Blind persecution of God's people. I can't tell you how often this scholar I was reading used the word, it caught in the crosshairs. They're just kind of caught in the crosshairs, caught in the middle. They just happen to be in the way. But what I do want you to see is what kind of reception he got when he arrived in Israel. Verse 32, two different responses. Some, it says, were seduced with flattery. We know what that looks like. They heard promises. They were persuaded to give up their faith. They joined his side, hoping to profit. They were taken in. They were seduced by him. Maybe they were protecting themselves. But others, you see, were ready. It says the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. And this is another story I'd love to tell you, but we just don't have time for it. But this is a reference to the Maccabean Revolution. When the Maccabeans stood up and said, we've had enough, and they fought. They organized these poor... I'm telling the story. I'm not going to tell the story. But this is where Hanukkah comes from. I mean, it's just an amazing story. But eventually they retook the temple and rededicated it in 164 BC. Just an incredible story. What does the phrase say? And those who knew their God stood firm and took action. Now, I don't know about you, but whenever you hear a story like this, or you hear a story about one of the martyrs of the Christian faith, or you hear a story about missionaries who pack their things in a coffin in order to go to a foreign land, whenever you hear stories like this, it's natural, I think, for us to ask the question, where would I have fallen? Would I have been seduced by flattery? Am I one of those people who know my God and know when to stand firm and to take action? That's a question worth asking yourself. And even as I say that, for those community groups that are meeting, it's worth thinking about this. What kind of faith does this require of me? The New Testament authors are preoccupied with making sure that we know that trials and tribulations aren't over for God's people, but they only continue. What did Jesus say? He said, in this world, you will have trials and tribulations. And some of you know that already. Some of you know that. I've talked with at least two, maybe three of you who over the last several years have said, I don't like the kind of work my work is requiring me to do. I don't know how longer I can keep doing this and call myself a good guy. And so at great cost to yourself, you took a risk and you went and found work or found relationships that were more God-honoring for you. I've known several of you who have made sacrifices in terms of friendship or lived somewhere, all for the sake of your faith or protect your faith. I know that some of you are very familiar with this. And listen, if this is not you, then I want you to know I'm happy for you. I'm not asking for for trials or tribulations for any one of you. But listen, how will you stand up? How will your faith hold up? Are you one of those people that could be seduced by flattery, or are you one of those people who know their God and know when to stand firm and take action? That's the question I want to ask you. And if you're not in one of those places, I want to ask you, what are you doing right now to prepare yourself for the trials and tribulations that are to come? How are you nurturing the deep root of faith internally that produces a beautiful life, a life that looks like Jesus? That's the question I want you to think about. All right, finally, assuring us. He gives them this vision to prepare us, and finally, God gives the people this vision to assure us, and I'm going to try to be quick here. As we move into verse 36, scholars generally agree that the vision is describing a different enemy, an enemy still to come. And the primary reasons that people think this, well, there are several different reasons. I'll just give you a few. One is that the Hebrew, the grammar changes a little bit as it moves into this. It's no longer describing the central figure isn't a king of the north or a king of the south. It's now just the king that you see in verse 36. And it seems to describe an enemy that's far more powerful, far more cruel than Antiochus ever was. Verse 36 and 37, he's far more bold. Verse 38, he's far more powerful. And by the time you get to verses 40 through 43, you see he's far more successful, far more ruthless. And this is what why one person described Antiochus Epiphanes as a shadow of this king who is to come. This is why many people look at this and they think, oh, this is a reference to the Antichrist that Jesus talked about. Other people look at this and think this is Paul's man of lawlessness that he described in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. That may be true. Whoever the vision is describing is telling us of a far greater trial that is to come. One where all hope might seem meaningless, one where no strength of fight can overcome. Unless there is one who fights for you. Listen, we're going to talk about a victory that comes next week. Chapter 12, perspective of a future victory. But I don't want you to leave here without seeing the hope that's written into verse 45. What does it say? It says, this great enemy shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. Listen, you can bank on it. God is promising that this enemy will go the way of every other enemy. Your great enemies, the last enemy, death, they all finish alone, defeated foes in the wake of God's victory. Ian DeGuid, he says, it is said often that all good things must come to an end. What this passage is communicating is that the same is true for all the bad things as well. But how? Here's my other news habit. There's one podcast I listen to every week, okay? Just one, sometimes two, depending. Unless you send me one, then I may or may not listen to that. But there's one that I typically like because it feels balanced. It doesn't feel reactive, you know, and they seem to steel man opposing arguments, and it just feels like mature and honest takes, which is a real feat nowadays. And they accomplish that, you know, most of the time. And about a week ago, there was this one where they just grew, the whole panel just grew very critical, very cynical about the future of the world. And it was very unlike them. And it seemed like the host kind of knew what was happening in the podcast. As it grew cynical and pessimistic about the future, the host kind of got a sense for it and closed the whole podcast by asking this question. Hey, can we just close this way? what are each of you optimistic about? And one person said, it was all very intelligent answers. One person said, I'm optimistic about Americans. I love the American spirit. I think we're a creative people. We generate things. We do what we say we're going to do. Like, he's just optimistic about American humanity, I guess. And another person said, I'm optimistic about the World Cup. I think it says great things about the world, you know? I mean, it just, we're all celebrating something together. It's been great. And the other pundit didn't say anything like that. I had suspected that he was a Christian in the past. I'd read some of his stuff, but what are you optimistic about? And all he said was, I know that my Redeemer lives. It wasn't a cry of victory. It was just, this is where my hope lies. And here's what I want you to understand, is that this is a past victory that promises a future victory. When Jesus went to the cross, the disciples must have been so despairing of the future. Some people thought it was a waste. But when we look at it, we see a king who rules like none of the other kings in this chapter. We see one who takes suffering on his own self for the good of his people. And when we look at his resurrection, we see the promise of the life to come. It invites us to look to our future with hope. And when we see Jesus ascend into heaven, we see a promise of the rule to come, the end of wars and the rumors of all war. In John 16, when Jesus says, in this world you will have trials and tribulations. You know how he finished that sentence? He said, take heart, for I have overcome the world. Let me pray. Oh, you, I pray, you who gives us heart, who calls us to take heart, I pray that you would encourage us now. Encourage us as we look at these things. Encourage us as we prepare to come to this table to receive from you. Remind your people again, by the taking of this bread and the taking of this wine, just how generous, just how present, just how assuring you are. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.